Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
My name is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. America, from border to border, coast to coast, and all the ships at sea. Streaming live from the County of Kings, Brooklyn, New York City, on the Heritage Radio Network. Are you ready for the fastest half hour on the internet today? It's the Mike and Judy Show. Spanning the globe for high-minded hijinks and lowbrow kicks to bring you the best in sex, drugs, rock and roll, and nuclear fission. They're too bad for radio and too good-looking for television. And now, here they are, to pluck the low-hanging fruit of the literati, your hosts, Mike Edison and Judy McGuire.
All right.
Excellent introduction by Reed Paley.
Man, I'm so excited today, Judy. This is great. Every show, we are just rolling. I didn't think we were going to be able to follow up Gary Lucas, guitar player for Captain Beefheart and Jeff Buckley, and yet we did with those crazy kudzu girls.
Oh, my God.
And today, our guest, I'm proud to say, is legendary sax man, Bobby Keys.
Yay!
Probably best known for his work with that popular music band, the Rolling Stones, who were popular. The Rolling Stones, also The Who, in fact. In fact, Bobby has played with The Stones, with The Who, with all four Beatles, and with Elvis Presley, not to mention Harry Nilsson, and was a star on the Joe Cocker's Mad Dog and Englishman tour. It just goes on and on and on, and we're celebrating Bobby's new book, Every Night's a Saturday Night, The Rock and Roll Life of Legendary Sax Man, Bobby Keys. I'm thrilled to have you. How's it going, Bobby?
Uncommonly fine, Mike.
And joining us also is the publisher of Counterpoint Books, Charlie Winton, also the publisher of Soft Skull Books, responsible for my latest opus.
And my next one.
Which we'll be talking about during the break when we're off the air.
Don't beat me up.
And the pizza's here, so let the party get started. You know, the first time I saw you play, Bobby, was on the Stones 81 tour, and you weren't the main sax guy. They had some other guy in there, and you can't...
I was the main sax guy.
For me, you're always the main sax guy.
The other guy was just there for a minute.
Yeah, right on. And they brought you out, you played the solo on Brown Sugar. I'm saying, that guy's got the best job in all of rock and roll.
Well, you see, we had a little bit of division in the camps back then. We won't go into that, but...
Come on.
I think we should.
Fight stories we love.
You know, I know, the Mick and Keith fight stories. I mean, you were Mick's best man at his wedding, and then he kind of, like, fucked you over, right? That's the way I'm reading your book.
Well, it wasn't exactly in those strong terms. Mick was a little more organized than I was, and I guess my disorganization at times put him off a little bit.
Well, you were one of the few guys, I think, who could keep up with Keith. I mean, you're pretty much the co-star of his book.
Yeah.
Well, he's my pal. You know, we got that December the 18th, 1943 common thing going. Sagittarians, brothers of the horoscope, Aaron asked Keith what his birthday... Well, when we found out what our birthday... We had the same birthday. He said, Bobby, you know what that means? I said, no, man, Keith, what does that mean? He says, that means we're double Sagittarians, man. Half horse, half man, and a license to shit in the streets. Never tried that, but always liked the sound of it.
The day is young. Nobody would notice in Bushwick either.
Here are the Mike and Judy Show.
Can you say streets?
You can say whatever you want.
Yeah, we're pretty far out on the show. So somehow, though, you walked through the door and you came out the other side and you survived this whole experience with Keith and the Stones. And I guess things are going well now. Are they going to hit the road? You going to be back on the road with the Stones?
Well, that's a question everybody's been asking me, and I'll give you the same answer. I don't know. I know when the phone rings, and Keith's always told me, he said, Bobby, when it's time, I'll give you a call. Don't worry about what you hear. Don't listen to nobody. Listen to me. So that's what I do. When a phone rings, the Keith's on the other end of it, I'll know it's official.
I mean, this is a big organization. This is the very essence of corporate rock. I mean, like you say in your book, and it's always fascinating to me, when you look at, you know, the 72 tour, the 69 tour, the 72 tour especially, that was, without a doubt, the most blazing with... unambiguously the greatest rock and roll band that's ever hit the fucking planet.
That was a great tour. You know, that's back when we went to the gigs in a camper. Everybody in the same camper. Yeah, we were disguised. Tourists in New York City.
In your camper.
But now, it just doesn't work like that. Everybody's showing up in separate cars and separate planes and separate buses.
Well, like you say, it's become a lot more structured and corporate, and there's a lot more people involved. You know, like now there's, I don't know, anywhere from 13 to 14 people, musicians and singers on stage. And back in the day, there was only, well, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Nicky Hopkins, Jim Price, myself, and the five other guys.
Yeah, but there was a looseness to that band at the time. I think part of it's now, too, is everything's on a, I don't think it's not on a click track, is it? But everything's counted in.
Well, actually, the tempos are preset. We spend a lot more time in rehearsal and getting ready for tours now than we used to. And things do have to be synchronized to go off with all the whistles and bells and the jumbotron and give those folks more bang for their buck.
Yeah, what do you think,
Judy? Do you miss the old days? Or do you... I mean, or
I miss being younger.
Yeah, don't we all, though?
Yeah, really.
Everybody except for Jack the engineer,
who is so he's a child.
That's good. So you're in town though with your new band, your
Suffering Bastards.
Tell us about that, because you're playing tonight at the Highline Ballroom. Is that right?
Yeah, we played there night before last and had a good crowd. And this is a bunch of guys from Nashville, where I now live. We got together. Actually, being a saxophone player in Nashville is a pretty lonely job.
Country music town, right?
There's lots of guitar players there, but not many horn blowers. So I got tired of sitting around and twiddling my thumbs. I ran across a buddy of mine, Chark Von Kinsolving, Gentleman Viking, who runs a club in Nashville. And I thought it'd be good if I needed a place to play, get friendly with the owner. And he actually helped put the band together that we have now. In fact, he did most of the putting it together.
There's a good story in your book about getting friendly with the owner of a club, Woody's Club, down in Miami, which seemed to be a club plus.
You talking about Woody?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm friends with Woody.
Yeah, and yeah, his club down in Miami, they seem to be not quite exactly in the rock and roll business, or not exclusively in the rock and roll business, let's say.
No, they serve lunch and tea.
Yeah. Tell us more. I haven't read the book yet.
Well, what it intimates, and I wouldn't want to say it says it's a matter of fact, you know, Bobby's, you know, being a Texas gentleman, he's more polite than that pirate Keith Richards, who just calls everybody out. And, I mean, Keith's book is almost as much of a junkie memoir as it is a rock and roll memoir. And I think you played a little closer to the vest, Bobby, but it seems like Woody's Club down in Miami was kind of a front for some...
Oh, okay.
Well, it was a front for my rock and roll band, Woody's Orphans.
See? You see, a Texas gentleman.
We got paid in crisp new $100 bills. And I never ask any questions. I like $100 bills, and I like people to keep giving them to me.
I find that's always the case with saxophone players. They never really ask a lot of questions. Leave that for the singer, right?
That's it. LV's got that section covered.
So let's go back to Texas. Let's when you started out, I love the stories. You were hanging out with Buddy Holly, and you saw these guys playing, and your stories on the Buddy Knox band a little bit.
Right.
And then you were playing with Little Eva, one of my all-time favorites, and you got to take the solo on the Locomotion at, like, the Paramount Theater.
Yes, that was a memorable experience. My first solo up there, I actually missed the microphone and stepped off into the orchestra pit. And that was my introduction to New York City rock and roll music. I was blinded by the light.
Yeah, and how did you stumble into the Rolling Stones camp?
Oh, that was a series of chance meetings. I met him first in San Antonio, Texas, when I was playing with Bobby V, and we were doing a Dick Clark Teenage World's Fair, and they were on the bill along with George Jones, and that was the bill, Bobby V, George Jones, and the Rolling Stones.
That's a weird bill.
And we were all staying at the same hotel. Brian and Keith were in the room next to me, and Brian was a saxophone player, and I'm a saxophone player. And we just got to talking, and their record at the time was a song called Not Fade Away, which was a Big Buddy Holly song and a Big Buddy Holly hit, and I was kind of, you know, and it had kind of an attitude about two of these English interlopers out here trying to play, you know, Texas rock and roll, and, you know, this is just not my cup of tea. However, they got out on stage and played it very, very well. It impressed the hell out of me.
Uh-huh.
So it kind of broke the ice when I was talking to Keith, and we discovered that, well, he knew that I told him I was from Lubbock, and I knew Buddy, and knew the guys, J.I. and Joe B. And that sort of, you know, kind of broke the ice, as I say, and then we found out we were both born the same day, same month, the same year, so conversation's been going on ever since then.
What kind of training did you have? Did you grow up playing the horn?
Well, not exactly growing up playing the horn. I started playing the horn when I was a freshman in high school, and the only reason I did it was because I wanted to join the band. I got hurt playing Little League baseball and I couldn't play football, which was no great loss to our football team. So I joined the band, and the only instrument left that you didn't have to buy was an old baritone saxophone.
And you loved it immediately?
I just stuck it in my face and started blowing.
We've heard a lot of that on this show.
Yeah.
Baritone's a monster, though. That takes a lot of wind to operate that saxophonic device, as you like to refer to it in your book.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I didn't have quite as much luggage to carry around with me back then as I do now, so the saxophone, actually, the saxophone was about as heavy as I was back then.
I like the story in your book. You're talking about playing with Yoko Ono, and you had the Barry sax out, and you hit that low, low note, which seemed to kind of turn her head around. I think she didn't have such a high opinion of you before you hit that note.
Well, something caught her ear that was very fortunate for me, and it was an interesting afternoon. I was living out in the county of Berkshire, Royal County of Berkshire, and John and Yoko had a property adjacent to the property that I was living on. And, go ahead.
I'm moving backwards, going rewind, but you were out on John Lennon's tear with Harry Nilsson and that whole gang. You know, and you said you managed to survive that too. I mean, you're one of the only guys. You survived Keith Richards and you survived John Lennon, you know, these you know, vicious weekends, long lost weekends.
Actually, John wasn't a complete perpetrator on those adventures. There was had a lot of help. There was a fellow named Keith Moon, another fellow named Harry Nilsson, and a supporting cast of myself and Jim Keltner and other notables, Jesse Ed Davis.
Yeah, these guys, a lot of these guys, well, John obviously, you know, died unfortunately, but by the time that happened, I think he was living a pretty clean and sober life, relatively. He was a house dad, mostly. I mean,
well, in Keith's book, he kind of paints him as a pussy, like saying he never left the house except for horizontal when he went to visit Keith. I mean, he didn't seem like he was keeping up, really.
John?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that last record, I mean, it's not exactly his finest moment on record. Actually, well, you were on the early John records, too, with some of the Walls and
Bridges. First song I played on of John's was a thing called Power to the People.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did several albums with John, Walls and Bridges being one of them, the rock and roll album being another, and another that I don't recall the name of. But that may have been a composite of John Lennon.
I like that rock and roll record. That was a Phil Spector produced record. And of course, he's a guy who's gotten his own world of trouble.
Yeah, that's right. Phil produced that. Phil also produced another album I worked on with George Harrison, All Things Must Pass album. Phil was a producer on that. And I worked with Phil in Los Angeles on some of his projects.
So you must have gotten along well with him, which didn't seem like a very easy thing to do.
Well, I got along with him pretty well. I kept my distance. Phil usually went around armed.
Yeah.
So
seems to be a lot of that.
Well, I mean, he pulled a gun on the Ramones, and then, of course, you know, the whole murder thing.
Yeah, that whole murder thing.
The only thing I ever saw him shoot was a tape recorder.
And what, pray tell, was on that tape recorder at the time?
The wrong thing.
Apparently.
It was slightly out of tune, I believe.
How did you play? What happened? You played with Elvis. What was that like? I mean,
that was an enlightenment. I was a last minute substitute. The fellow that was originally booked for the session had a family emergency and had to leave town, and I got a call from a piano player who was on the session and asked me to bring my horn down to the RCA studios in Hollywood. And I'd just gotten out to L.A. I was still pretty young.
Mm-hmm.
And I went down. I thought it was for him. The session was for him. And I take my horn and go down there ready to do my first Hollywood session. And they had sheet music out there, which scared the hell out of me because I don't read music. So I had Glenn D. come out and counsel me on what it was. He said, well, Bobby, you got the very opening. You got the first note on the record. I said, oh, my God.
Wow.
So it was written down. I said, I had Glenn D. tell me, play that on the piano. Show me what that is. So I got that. And I still didn't know it was for Elvis. I didn't know who it was for. And so we're running it down, and I see behind the control room window, a door open. People come in, and immediately a definite change in the atmosphere of the studio, because there he was, the king of rock and roll. So and he looked like the king of rock.
Did he really?
Yeah.
Back when he was good looking?
Well, he was always bad.
When was he not good looking? You know, the one thing about Elvis is he never sang a bad note in his whole fucking life. No matter how wasted he was on pills and drugs, even if you listen to these bootlegs of him slurring words, he's slurring right on key, right on pitch, perfect. I mean, the guy couldn't fucking help himself. He was, you know, a natural. He was just one of those guys.
He was Elvis Presley.
He was Elvis Presley.
What made you decide to write an autobiography? And Charlie, how did you... Did you approach Charlie, or did...
Charlie can give you more information on that process.
A friend in the business was visiting one afternoon, and it wasn't, this was at the very end of the conversation, he just asked me, he had a friend who was working with a musician in Nashville on a book, had I had ever heard of Bobby Keys. So, you know, I said, of course I know Bobby Keys. I first saw the Stones at 72. I'd watched, you know, I've been a huge fan. And I said, point them in our direction whenever they're ready to go. Mm-hmm. And so about 6 months later, I got a call from this gentleman named Bill Dietenhofer, who is the guy who worked with Bobby on writing the book. And Bill's young guy, Nashville. Younger, at least younger than us.
And a musician. Which
and a musician.
A lot.
Oh, yeah.
And so basically, I said, you know, hell, I'll help, but I'd like to publish the book. I think it could be a great book. And I was familiar, you know, I thought I was pretty familiar with Bobby's work. But, you know, when we started doing the book, it, there were obviously parts of his life that I hadn't, you know, totally been tuned into. But I thought it was a tremendous, you know, it was a unique story, mm-hmm. sort of, as we were doing an interview early in the week, focus on people who are, you know, in the band and somebody who's not necessarily the lead singer, the guy out in front or the woman out in front. You know, a lot of the times the book's coming from the star. And
right.
So somebody who is, you know, in the whole scene.
And one thing I really like about this book is there's a real sense of humility to this book. You know, it isn't, you know, the book by the guy at the front of the stage. And I love it when you talk about the sax solo in Brown Sugar, which you know, you've played, you know, 8,000 times at least, and you say that it's always fresh and it's always the same solo, of course, what the kids want to hear, what's on the record, and you're not tired of playing it.
No.
And you got zero attitude, and I love that. It's so refreshing. I mean, I've met a lot of guys who are bitter because they get to be known for one thing, and 30 years later, they're still working the same hit and don't realize that it's a gift from fucking God. You know, it's a privilege. And you seem to embrace that, and every time you play it, it does sound fresh, and it's great. And that's one thing I love about your playing, and I love about this book.
Well, thank you very much. And all I got to say is I'm one lucky son of a bitch.
All right, tell you what. Let's take a quick break. Let's listen to Brown Sugar. And after that, we're going to have an old-fashioned Downbeat Magazine-style blindfold test. I got a few records queued up for you.
Cool.
It's Mike and Judy with Bobby Keys. All right, and we're back, broadcasting live from Roberta's here in Bushwick, the County of Kings, Brooklyn, USA. It's Mike Edison, Judy McGuire, and our very special guest, Bobby Keys.
Yay!
Yay, along with
the last
real publisher in the world, Charlie Winton of Soft Skull. And,
who has exquisite taste in authors.
Unbelievable. Judy, don't you have a new book coming out on the Soft Skull Press?
You know, I don't think I've ever gotten the title of my book right.
I have the same problem with mine.
It's the official Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll book of lists.
So I believe it's the official book of Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll lists.
See, I always screw that up, but yeah. And out in July.
I cannot wait, and I cannot wait for that party as well. Uh-huh. I'll tell you what, let's play a game. We have Bobby Keys here, and we were just listening to maybe the greatest rock and roll sax solo in history. No?
Well, I'll tell you, that's an awfully lofty bit of praise there, and I appreciate it. But there's been a few others that are pretty noteworthy.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's play this game. Jack, why don't you cue up the first record, and let's give it a listen, and you can tell us what you think, Bobby.
All righty. Yeah, Junior.
Yeah. Oh, shotgun.
Got it right off the bat. We need a buzzer.
I could name that song in one shotgun blast. Jimmy Walker and the All-Stars. I used to love going to see him. I don't know who else is even doing it anymore like that.
Well, I don't know. Last time I saw Junior was in Albuquerque, New Mexico, about 10 or 11 years ago at some movie theater there, and it just made my socks roll up and down just the same as it did the first time I saw him.
Yeah, it was the greatest. Used to go see him over at the Lone Star Cafe all the time, and he carried, you know, a big B3 organ with him, and no one else was doing that stuff at the time. I don't think he gets nearly enough credit as a lot of the other Motown acts.
No, I don't know about... I mean, he gets all the credit in the world for me. I guarantee you that. There's some other fellas I had a big partiality to, too.
I can bet. Maybe, let's see, maybe we got someone coming up. Jack, you got the second record queued up? Here's a... I told you, no tricks on this test.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jersey.
Oh, yeah, well, of course, Clarence. I'm sitting here listening. You wait for me to tell you who it was. Well, hell yeah, that's Clarence Clemons, man.
Yeah, he's got that big warm sound.
Yeah, I was just sitting here listening. You want me to answer questions?
I was like, how do I know a song that Bobby Keys doesn't know?
Well, you're from New Jersey.
I love Bruce.
I know
I was
you
very
do.
Sad about Clarence.
Yes, indeed.
I saw you quoted in the paper about his replacement. Or what they should look for. I think it was in the Daily News or the Post.
Post.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. You ready for the next clip, Jack? This is good. I mean, Clarence, the big sound. Let me remember what the next one is. Aha. Yeah, that is the king of white boy rock. That's Bill Clinton.
I know you're funning this country boy on that one. Who is that?
That was Bill Clinton on the Arsenio Hall show.
Was that Bill Clinton?
That's Bill Clinton. I can hear his Ray-Bans from here.
Oh, yeah, that's Bill Clinton.
Yeah. That's got to be the whitest shit I've ever heard in my life.
He was at one of our Stones concerts, and I had a couple of saxophones with me, and I actually walked up to Bill after being suppressed by the Secret Service. Hey, you want to play horn? No, I don't do that much anymore since the Arsenio Hall show.
and really,
that was his last
gig. And I guess Bruce wasn't on the phone calling him up after Clarence passed either.
Yeah, well, it'd be a hard call to make.
All right, we got a couple more. What's next, Jack?
He can't tell
Hello
you.
Oh, me.
Boy, do I look bad.
This would be the Coasters. We just jumped out and did the same song.
Yeah, but...
Walks in the classroom.
Well, King Curtis played that on the record, but that wasn't King Curtis.
No, that's the original recording of the Coasters doing it.
Is it? Well, that's not King Curtis.
All right.
I don't think. Not the one I knew.
Yeah.
But there's other sax players that played on Coasters records besides Curtis.
Mm-hmm.
Curtis played on Yakety Yak.
Right.
And I
think we should defer to the master.
Absolutely.
That's
not King Curtis.
Did you think it was King Curtis?
I did think it was King Curtis because I thought he was the guy that played most of that stuff. And I did check his discography, and he was listed on Charlie Brown as well as Yakety. Yeah. Yakety Yak's probably the most famous.
Yeah. There were some other horn players on there. I asked Ahmet Erdogan when I first got to know him because Ahmet, you know, put all those sessions together, him and Nezui and Jerry Wexler, I guess. But... Well, I don't know, man. You know, the old ears are not quite what they used to be, but I did not get a King Curtis vibe from that. But as a guy, you know, I'm pretty clear on what Curtis sounds like.
Yeah, he was one of your favorites, right?
He was the man.
King Curtis.
He was the man for me.
All right, we got one more on the blindfold test.
Well, I hope I get it.
I think you're going to get this one. If you don't get this one, we're going to have a problem.
Oh, yeah. That was done right here in New York City.
That would be the man himself, Bobby Keys, playing with John Lennon and Elton John lurking somewhere in the background, right?
Come down to the Highline tonight and hear this one.
What time at the Highline?
8:30, I think.
8:30, yeah.
Oh, reasonable time.
A reasonable time for people our age. Exactly. God, remember when we used to go on stage at midnight, 1 a.m, waiting for somebody to get a fix, and the audience is waiting and waiting and waiting? World's not like that anymore. So, yeah, there you are, the John Lennon's only number one hit.
Yeah, that was, playing with John and working with John was one of the best experiences I had in my life because I really liked that fella. He was a hell of a nice guy and a hell of a musician. Also, he meant what he said. I mean, the man was not, he wasn't wishy-washy about expressing his views.
That's good. I think people are kind of hedging their bets these days.
You never know who's listening.
You never know who's listening.
Well, so would he be your favorite Beatle?
Yes.
And you've worked with them all.
Yeah, I mean, yes. They all, John, because I spent more time with John. I spent a lot of time with Ringo. And I spent some time with George during the making of All Things Must Pass. I stayed out at his house in England.
Speaking of Ringo, who I think is one of the most underappreciated drummers in the history of the sport, I think, you know, Ringo has got this like amazing vibe to his playing. He's got a great feel. And you've also played with who is, without a doubt, the greatest rock and roll drummer in the history of the sport, to me anyway, Charlie Watts.
Absolutely.
The guy who Keith says is the one guy in the band that's not replaceable.
He's the engine.
And it's amazing. I mean, what is it about Charlie's thing? To me, and tell me if I haven't quite figured it out, because I listen to the Stones and I try to figure out the formula and why it swings so fucking hard. And I think it's because Keith is on the beat and Charlie's just a little bit behind him, pushing him, you know. And then maybe Bill is like right on the beat, like right.
Well, I never dissected it down to that degree. I just know that it makes me wobble when they play.
Yeah, well, it's my job to be the geek. It's your job to play the horn.
No, you know, Keith and Charlie particularly, man, have a wonderful partnership, you know, and that rhythm up there on stage is just like a train coming down the tracks.
And they could not be more different personally, it seems.
That's true. There's quite a diverse bunch of bouquet of personalities in that band.
Yeah, one would think.
We've got Brenda.
Poor Brenda. I mean, these are the stories in the book is, you know, you had left the Stones on your own volition. Things were getting a little disorganized, as you like to say.
What was the bathtub story, though? That was...
Everybody wants to know, Bobby. You're never going to live it down. It's between that and the cocksucker blues.
Yeah, it's either that or throwing appliances out the window of a hotel. Yeah.
And let me say that should not be underestimated, because I have thrown TVs out of windows, and the sound a 14-inch RCA color track makes after flying 14 stories is not to be believed. So don't knock it until you've tried it. I'm just saying to you kids at home.
I don't get the musician urge to throw televisions out
windows. Well, it wasn't an idea by the musicians. The guys that were filming this epic tour said, do something rock and rolly. You know? We're in Denver, Colorado, and we just gotten in there. We kind of, left over from the day before. Do something rock and rolly. All right, so okay. There wasn't anything in the room that was except a TV set. So we just hoisted it up, tossed it out the window, and little did I know that distinguishment was going to follow me for the rest of my life. Doesn't matter how many songs or records I played on. The main question is, oh, you're the guy that threw the TV out the window with Keith Richards. Yeah, that's it. That's my claim to fame.
Well, you know, I'd say the hot chick in a bathtub full of champagne is a better thing to follow you. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's like that joke Paul McCartney likes to tell you. Fuck one goat.
Paul said
that. Hey, you've worked with Paul as well.
Not really. He was there.
Bobby,
I was there.
It's just amazing. I mean, probably the greatest Wikipedia page in the history of Wikipedia. You know, I mean, the whole thing's just amazing. Leonard Skinner, Warren Zevon, there are all these great surprises. I want to come back to, just before we go, though, the Mad Dogs and Englishmen tour, because watching that film, and I don't think Joe Cocker's got the hip cash he once had amongst, you know, these punks out here in Bushwick. They probably don't even know who the fuck he is. But what a singer. But what a band. And what a show. Who has a space choir? Who can afford one?
Well, I didn't even know we had one until we got on the plane. And there they were. God bless them.
Ah, man, the craziness of the tour. You don't miss all that craziness? You like it better organized the way it is now? With the Stones especially?
Those are beautiful memories. But today, in practical application, it kind of wouldn't be quite... as easy to pull off as it was back then. That's about 40 years ago.
Yeah, I just feel like sometimes, you know, just that controlled tempo, and I know it's got to do with sinking into the Jumbotron and the pyro, but it just seems there. It's just not loose. It's just not the way it was. Because if you look at those old tapes of you guys playing with you and Jim standing there, as, you know, the only, you know, I mean, now they're like 15 sidemen up on that stage.
Yeah.
You know, there are more people in the Stones than there are in the LA Philharmonic, it seems, on some nights. You know, and it just seems so raw and so right, and some of those songs are so fucking out of control and fast. You know, Midnight Rambler, it's like a symphony to violence. You know, it's like the Mahler of rock and roll. It just seems it's a shame we've gone past that day.
Yeah, I love watching that song. Mick used to get so upset with the stage, he'd kneel down and bang on it with his belt. Boy, doesn't like lumber.
Exactly.
Oh, Brenda.
He did go for that giant inflatable penis. You weren't on that tour. Probably thankfully.
Actually, I was on that tour.
Yeah? I didn't get my facts wrong here. The inflatable penis tour?
You betcha. Who could miss that?
Once again, Judy, it's been the fastest 30 minutes on the internet today. Can you believe it?
Very fast.
So, once again, the book is called
Every Night's a Saturday Night.
The Legendary Life of Legendary Saxman Bobby Keys, who's been our fabulous guest. Bobby, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
I am entirely starstruck. And Charlie Winton, the last real publisher in the business. Good to see you, Charlie.
Nice,
Mike and Judy, I'm Mike Edison, and we'll go out with one of Bobby's more famous riffs. Thank you
so much. It's been great being here.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.